Hello, and welcome back to the Agility Rose Talk and Train podcast. So this week's episode is very exciting. I say that every week, but I genuinely mean it. And I had a super interesting conversation with Sammy Toe, who is a canine physiotherapist. She's also done hydrotherapy and many other aspects when it comes to our dog's fitness. So Sammy answered your questions and we had a really interesting discussion. I learned so much and I hope you guys do too. But before we get into it, just a quick word about our sponsors. So if you didn't know already, we are very honoured to be sponsored by both Naylor Agility and Paws Trading. Naylor Agility are a family-run agility equipment business. They provide the most high-end tunnels I've ever used and trained on. They currently have a non-slip plus range, which takes our dog's safety to the next level. So if you want to have a catch up with me at a show or want to pop me a message just to hear about what our experiences have been like so far in more detail, by all means get in touch. But I have been so impressed so far this winter with their tunnels and how they've held in the bad weather, because unfortunately we're in the UK and I train outside all year round. So if you are interested in more information, do give me a shout. I'll link their website into the show notes, but I also have a code ELISE10 and that gets you 10% off at the discount. And we are super duper proud to represent Paws Trading as well. So I cannot imagine going anywhere else for all of my dog paraphernalia when I need a tug toy or when I need a treat, whether that's long lasting or training treats. They have everything. They also sell vet bed, bedding, bowls, you name it, they've got it. And I know when I get to a show and if I forgot something, they're the first point of call when I need to get lots more treats and toys, because they have just such a variety and they're at most of our shows across the country, and I definitely recommend them. The team is so friendly, and if you have any specific requests, they're always very happy to help. They have great deals, whether that's bulk buying or whether it's crust deals. Keep an eye out for those, they'll be coming up soon. But Paws Trading is such a friendly, family-run team, so definitely check them out, and I'll pop a link in the show notes. Hi, Sammy. Thank you for joining me. I'm very excited for this topic. I think it'll be super cool. So today we're talking about common agility injuries, preventions, and treatments. So for people who haven't heard of you before, could you give us a quick introduction to yourself, your dogs, how long you've been doing agility for, and what your biggest achievement is to date?
Okay. Hi, everyone. Well, thank you for listening. So to start off from a professional point of view, I have a postgraduate diploma in veterinary physio, and that's how I got my physio qualification. I have a level 3 in hydrotherapy as well, which both work beautifully hand in hand. I work at a vet's 3 days a week as a physio / hydrotherapist. And then I've also got my business on the side. My dogs, I've got 3 Shetland sheepdogs, one that currently doesn't live with me. She lives with my parents. My original dog, Penny, who's now 13. She was the one that I started off with agility back in the days. And one of the questions was, how long have I done agility? I looked it up because I was like, I don't actually know. So she's 13 years old. So probably, you wouldn't start with her. I started off with Millie, actually. My 13th birthday present, she was Millie. Oh. She didn't really enjoy agility though, so I kind of can't really say I did agility with her, but I kind of played around with it with her back in 2011. So I'd probably say I've been doing agility for 13 years, but properly with Penny for 12 years ish onward. Oh, this is a hard one as well to try and pinprick like the best one. But like with Penny, my biggest achievement with her was definitely going abroad and doing the AWC and EO for Team GB, and getting clear rounds as well, which was my goal when I was going there.
Amazing.
And at EO 2019, our team also got a 4th place in one of the rounds, which
that's really cool.
I felt was a big achievement at the time, and it wasn't a medal, but it was still a 4th place.
Absolutely.
And then Frankie, I'd say my biggest achievements with him is getting a bronze medal in Spain with IMCA and two championship tickets. So,
Awesome.
yeah, I
Oh,
don't like talking about myself, but.
no, that's incredible. And I think our first question leads really nicely because obviously we've talked about your experiences there. So, how have your experiences as an agility competitor shaped your experiences as a physiotherapist and the treatments you give your clients?
Yeah, it's a long-winded, isn't it?
Yeah.
So I think the main thing is, like, from doing the sport, I can understand how it works, the different levels of grades, the different things that people try to qualify for, and also, like, applying the principles of understanding what is required from the dog for the sport. There's quite a lot involved, like muscle strength, muscle power, endurance, flexibility, proprioception. Like, there's such a massive amount involved in what a dog's required to do in agility and how you can then target physio towards that. I think also, like, knowing the events, like, if you were my client, I'd ask you what your goal is, like, what events have you got coming up that mean to you the most, and how can I work with you to try and get your dog, like, peak for that event? And then also, if you've got an injury, like, creating a rehab plan. Obviously, if the dog's injury cannot be fixed in time, obviously, welfare is the main issue, but if I can try and target it to get your dog fit enough to run, I will do. And, like, for example, on that topic, when I was being physio for Team England, there was a dog out there that became lame.
Oh, God.
And I'm not going to name anyone because it's confidentiality, but I had to really think on my toes to try and help this dog get through and then fix it later, rather than saying, this dog cannot run. Obviously, if it was quite a severe injury, I would do. But it's weighing up the pros and cons for what that owner needs at that time. And also, I think from a physio point of view, you learn to look for the more subtle changes. Like, if when I'm at the vets and I've got dogs with conditions, it's obvious, there's more an obvious lameness. Whilst when you're working with soft tissue injuries, which is what agility dogs mainly have, you look for the more subtle changes that can be, like, to do with posture and form and that kind of thing. So, yeah.
That's
Have I
really
answered
cool.
your
Yeah,
question?
absolutely. And I really like how you touched on there about like when you're working with clients, prepping them for the specific events, because I assume the difference in surface that the dogs will be running on, they'll use potentially different muscles, I guess, sand compared to grass, those kind of differences, I guess, is going to make a big impact on the dogs. So knowing how to best support them, that's really cool.
Surface is a good one because the proprioceptive differences between them, and also different dogs cope with different surfaces. So I always ask that question to owners, like, what's the event that they're training for? And then obviously, if it's Crufts, it's AstroTurf, and then you can just try and get the owners to think about how their dogs cope on the different surfaces is a
Absolutely.
starting point as well.
Absolutely. And I think, I guess, as well, when you're looking at it, is like runs too, because I think, things like obviously WAO, CSJ, you've got quite a few days that you're competing across. So it's keeping the dogs fit over that longer period, I guess, as well, which impacts them.
Yeah, definitely. Absolutely.
Awesome. Okay, cool. Anything else, or are we happy to move on?
Well, I guess so. If I have a client that's just been training or just agility trained the day before, I wouldn't get them to do, like, if they come for hydrotherapy, for example. I combine physio and hydro together because, as being a physio, I can never just be a hydrotherapist. Like, if I do hydrotherapy, I can't just switch my physio off. So it's a combined approach when I do it. So if someone wants to come for hydrotherapy straight after competing, I wouldn't do it as, like, a fitness session. I'd do it more as, like, an active recovery session.
Oh,
So
cool.
working more on, like, massage, improving flexibility, because if you've done a lot of intense training over a period of time, muscles shorten. So my treatment goal would be to try and improve flexibility and do massage and passive range of motion and that kind of thing. So you know, I'd ask the question to the owners, have you done a lot of training in the last few days or not? And then also, I guess, going back on like trying to get them ready for a specific event, the session might be focusing on trying to work on home exercises and increasing their strength. So the treatment for that session might be working on home exercise program. I think, yeah, that kind
That's
of
really
answers
cool.
the question,
Yeah.
actually.
And I
Yeah.
like that, like how you're adapting it based on what the dog's done, because I guess, you know, some people who do agility won't know what, when they come into a physio session, what they need to be doing before, like should they be giving the dog a bit of a rest into it, or and as you say, you can't switch off your physio when you're doing hydro and vice versa. That
I
must
think
be super
it's always a
difficult.
combined approach with that.
Yeah, but you can never complain because then you've covered every angle, so that's pretty cool.
Yeah, definitely.
That's pretty cool. Awesome. Okay, next question. So how often would you recommend seeing a physio, massage therapist and or a chiropractor for a working agility dog, I guess?
I think this is a really hard question.
Yeah.
It's like a bit of a cop-out, but, you know, every owner and dog is different. Like the age of the dog might have an impact, the owner's financial situation and commitment, what their goals are, like if they've got like a, and when their goals are need to be achieved, if they've got a pre-existing condition or injury, I might need to see the dog more often and try and get them, you know, fixed. So it's a very hard question to kind of make an answer, but if I think of it in another way, if I think of it as in like at a minimum, because obviously people's finances cannot always allow them to see therapist often, I say at a minimum, I think every 3 months having a checkup, like throughout the working season, if they don't work the whole year, I think having every 3 months checkup, and a pre-season at the beginning of the season checkup, because I think it's not, physio is not just targeted towards dogs that have injuries, you know. So you might not know that your dog is competing out there and hiding a slight asymmetry or a muscle niggle that might progress onto something more, and then you'd be kicking yourself in the foot if you think that you're. So yeah, I think at a minimum every 3 months, from a maximum point of view, like if you're training for a specific event, you probably want the support and the help more frequently, more advice on, you know, is your dog doing your exercise prescription right? And, you know, the important thing with exercise prescription is increasing the intensity to build muscle. So you want progressively overload muscle. So if you went away and did a set number of exercises that I set you today for weeks on end, your dog will find it easy and the muscle just won't grow. So you need to increase the reps and the sets and the difficulty of the exercises over a period of time to help with that. Again, this question was two part, wasn't it? Because it said physio, massage and chiro. So they're all quite different. And I'm always open-minded to working with other professionals because I think they all have, definitely all have a play. It's like with massage therapists, they can recommend exercises for maintenance, but when you're working on a rehab plan, it's difficult for them to create exercise plans for specific conditions just because their assessment methods can be quite different to physios. And I think massage is good for maintenance, and also massage therapists and all be different and they might have different qualifications, because I know a lot of physios that have done massage therapy first, so they have like a multimodal approach. And also there are loads of different types of massage all focusing on the same thing. So I think massage is like improving muscular health, and extensibility and range of motion. So massage, if you're going to go to a massage therapist and that's the only treatment you get, I'd use it more for like active recovery, intermittently. Physiotherapists, we also do massage, but we also have the electrotherapies that we use, which again, massage therapists can also use if they go on CPDs. And then like the physio side of things, we can do exercise prescription in more detail. Again, it kind of depends on the therapist and their experience and what they've exposed themselves to. Because I tend to have taught a lot of my exercise prescription from trial and error with my dogs and talking to other physios as well that understand the sport. So it depends on the therapist's experience to what they can advise you to do from the exercise point of view. And then chiropractors, they focus mainly on like manipulations of joints, like low impact adjustments, like realigning and balancing the musculoskeletal system. Again, like I say, they might have other qualifications under their belt, and they tend to understand soft tissue mobilization techniques, massage. But they sometimes are not generally trained in a rehab program. So again, it's getting to know each therapist and how they play a part. And I think the key thing with all three of them is finding one of them that has sports understanding.
Yes.
They can give you that sports baseline and let you make an informed choice about where they all like lie in your plan.
It's a hard question. No, waffle's great. But yeah, I think that's really interesting. And I really like that you highlighted, obviously, there the financial side of it, because I think that's something that, you know, there's sometimes a lot of pressure when you're kind of doing agility, and maybe people who are first getting into the sport thinking, oh my God, now I need to take my dog to all these treatments. I don't even spend that on myself. I mean, I know I've got my dogs, they've all got their massage appointments this weekend, and that's, you know, a three-figure amount that's going to cost me. And regularly, obviously, it does add up. So I think, like you said, that it's really important to highlight that. And, you know, doing those little checkups are probably going to save people money in the long run, I guess, as well. You know, injury prevention, kind of getting them seen regularly. I think that'll
be
really...
Because if you've got a dog that injures, you'll need that more support and more intensity. Yeah. So
absolutely.
The financial side of it will definitely go up.
Yeah.
Do that, support that. Yeah.
Absolutely. Because I think we do forget, you know, with agility, I know it doesn't always look as high impact as maybe other sports like flyball, but in fact, the amount of impact they're doing on the equipment, onto the ground, like there's a lot that's going on to their bodies. So I think there's definitely high risk of injury there, isn't there?
Definitely. And there's a lot more variability, like the amount of different types of turns and inclines, declines, weaving action. Like flyball is majority in a straight line as well. There's a massive variability in agility.
Absolutely. And I think I think definitely injury prevention is going to be a lot more cost effective in the long run. But no, that's really cool. And I really like that you explained as well the differences between the three, because I think that's a common thing that people get maybe confused or feel overwhelmed by, that not knowing who to approach, because there's so much option out there now.
Yeah, and which one to, where they fit where, and which one to prioritize. And
absolutely.
You know, I think the key thing is to talk to the therapist. Like an understanding therapist will allow you to just talk on the phone and discuss, you know, how they would be suitable for you.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't expect you to dive right in and just, you know, book an appointment. You know, my phone's always open for people to ring and talk about how I can help them.
Awesome. No, that's really cool. And, you know, I think, as you highlighted as well, having someone with sports experience is also so beneficial, you know, from what you've said already. And I've had it personally as well recently. I've kind of gone to someone with sports specific experience, and the difference was incredible. Like knowing what my dogs had and what they needed, it definitely made a huge difference. So, no, awesome. Anything else, or are we happy to move on?
Yeah, I think I'm happy.
Cool. That was really good. Awesome. Okay, so next question. What's the best way or the best exercises to use in a warm-up and cool-down routine when training and competing?
Okay. So I think it's, to start with, I think it's important to say, so like you say best way. Unfortunately, in dogs, the research into how warm-ups affect dogs is lacking, and specifically in like agility, that in sport and agility. So a lot of like the research I've done to understand warm-up in dogs, it's mainly extrapolated from humans and human sports. So the best way in hyphens has not really been discovered. I think it's kind of trialing error the ways that humans do in their sports and applying it to your dog. And I think also, what's the question? It's like exercises to use in a warm-up.
Yeah,
so
I think it mentions about exercises as well.
Yeah, exercises specifically, which is quite so like within a warm-up you've got like passive and you've got active. So I think when you say exercises, they're probably talking more about an active warm-up rather than passive. So I'll just define the two differences. So active is like your body temperature will increase when you're actually contracting your muscle and using your muscle, whilst passive is something external that heats it up, like a water bottle or a coat. So if you're talking about exercise, you're probably talking more on the active side of things. And I think, so with active, I think it's probably better described through the different steps that I would recommend, rather than explaining the best one per se, because I wouldn't go into, for example, stretching straight away when I've not warmed up the cardiovascular system. So I think from an active warm-up, you could start off with like toileting your dog, walking your dog on the lead, trotting, using changes of direction. And I think the important thing to understand with warm-up as well, you can tailor it to your dog and tailor it to their behavioral needs as well. So you're not only warming up the body, but you can warm up their mind and your relationship and your like connection with them before you go in the run. So involving like toy play and impulse control, which I do a lot with Frankie before I warm him up, like doing your weights and your stays before you release them and getting them used to that. And also within your walk and your trot and your change of directions, you can use handling techniques when you're warming them up. So something, for example, that I can do is put him in a weight, release him and do a front cross and then drive to a toy. And I tend to tailor it towards whatever I'm about to run in a course as well. So that can be the first part of the warm-up. You can also do things like sidestepping and reversing. And then after you've kind of primed the body and warmed it up in doing those sort of things, you can then go into the stretching part and things. And I think the important part thing to say about stretches in dogs is you want to do it actively rather than passively. So what I mean by that is you basically ask the dog to do a movement, so they're controlling the end range of their joints, compared to if you're passively stretch, or otherwise known as a static stretch, where, for example, you might physically touch the dog's leg and stretch it to end range and hold it for a period of time. That's actually in human research shown to be quite detrimental to do before competing in sports. So I think it's important that you actively stretch their dog so that they're controlling their own end ranges and what you do. And an example of an active stretch might be a spinal baited stretch, where you get your dog to move their head round to their ribs so that they're bending their back. So that's like a spinal range of motion. And thinking about what stretches you do, I'd definitely use a therapist to help you with this. I think it's difficult for me to say, do this exercise without knowing your dog. And I think you need kind of demonstration. So, like, for example, you wouldn't talk to a yoga instructor over the phone. You'd have a demonstration, because you need to have the correct form and the posture to be able to do it effectively. Talking about the different ones, making sure you've got a therapist to know what to do. And then moving on from active stretches, and then got a category called like muscle power exercises.
Okay.
So you start to do a bit more explosive stuff, switching on your fast twitch muscle fibers. So they're more higher intensity and shorter duration. And you don't want to do too many explosive muscle things, because you don't want your dog to fatigue. In your warm up, the key thing is just to prime the body and warm the body up. You don't want your dog's muscles to be shaking on the start line or having fatigue, because you've got a higher risk of injury then. So I think it's important to know your dog and how much, muscle strength exercises they can cope with before they go in the ring. And then you can also use a warm-up jump as well, if there is one at the event. But I think the important thing is to have a therapist support to help know how to do the exercises, and understanding your own dog and targeting towards your own dog, because your dog might have a previous injury, so you might need to focus your warm-up in a certain anatomical area where they've had a previous injury, or an area you know that they might get tight. I think behavior is also a key thing to think of. For example, Astro, my boyfriend's border collie, if we do a lot of the warm-up too close to the ring, he gets really wound up. So you got to think of how your dog's behavior and where to do different parts of the warm-up in relation to their behavior. Have I mentioned everything?
That was really cool. I think that was very very in depth, and like I say, it's again, it's another hard question, because it's a lot of it is down to the individual and what works for that dog's routine. And I really like that you touched on behavior there, because I like you anything I mean I come from a behavior background, so it has such an impact on your dog's like mental and physical. And I think it's one people often forget. So like you say, you know, watching where you're warming them up, because otherwise it's probably going to be what's the word I'm looking for? Detrimental in the fact that they're not going to do the exercises as they need to, or they're not going to be doing the full kind of range of motion, I guess, because obviously if they're overexcited and overwhelmed, you're not going to get the same out of them. So that's really cool to get that mentioned in there. And I think as well, I like that you touched on the passive and the active, because I think that's such a important thing to kind of describe the two. So when it comes to passive, I know you touched on coats and like keeping the body warm. Is there anything you want to go into about passive, like things that you could do to help? Again, I guess it kind of supports the active sort of side of things.
So I guess the main passive things you use are a coat, a hot water bottle, and they tend to be used in colder weather. You can do massage is quite a passive one. And I think the key thing with passive things is they're more of a buffer. So if you've warmed your dog up and then, you know, inconveniently something happens in the ring, which it happens at agility, and your time has elapsed between you've warmed up and you're going to run, you can use your passive techniques as like a buffer between those things. But I think the key thing is not to just do passive warm-up. So funnily enough, I love doing warm-up workshops, and it's something that I'm quite passionate about. And people will commonly say, oh, I just put a coat on my dog, or I just do a little bit of massage. And it's like, no, like the best warm-up for them is, you know, to start getting them to do movements themselves, and you know, initiate the cardiovascular system and get the blood flow going, because a passive alone is not going to be effective in warming them up. Basically, it's just a buffer for that time period.
Interesting. No, that's really cool. And I think, like I say, it's such a good thing to highlight, because it is very common, I guess, people, like you say, they'll go, oh, I just put the coat on and it keeps them warm, but it's not doing what we need it to, which is obviously the active movement. So no, really cool. That's very interesting. And I think I've learned a few things in there as well. So thank you. Awesome. Okay. So this one's another one quite interesting. And I think it's a common debate as well. When I've seen it on AgilityNet, people ask this question a lot. So when it comes to spay, so I'm guessing we're talking specifically with girls, but if we want to talk about boys, that's fine too. But with girls, obviously we have the traditional option or the keyhole. So out of the two, is there a preference when it comes to the dog's physio point of view, and how long would you advise before returning to agility? And then there is another question into this, but I won't go into that one yet, so we'll do those two first.
This is a really juicy question. It's quite controversial as well. I know it's quite argumented in the veterinary world as well. So what's the first part of it? Keyhole or traditional spay? So I think the first thing I'll say before I answer this question is my answers are an opinion rather than an evidence-led advice. So I think you always should talk to a veterinarian to get the proper veterinarian advice to what's right for your dog, because every dog's different. They might have different health issues. So, you know, I don't want you to go off and say, well, Santo said this and I can't do that. Like, no, like get veterinary advice. So I think the first part is to try and describe the difference between the two, because some people might not know. So a traditional spay, otherwise known as a over your hysterectomy, I'll make sure I pronounce that right, That's when the ovaries, the uterine horns, and the uterine body are removed. Whilst keyhole, which is otherwise known as laparoscopic, is only the ovaries are removed, providing that the uterus is healthy. So this is something that I've actually been quite passionate about recently. And the luxury of working at a vet's, I've actually gone and observed some traditional spays at the vet's, just to try and work my physio mind and actually see what goes on. Because from a physio perspective, I want to know what is cut, what tissue is cut, to not kind of think about how long it would take to heal, so I could answer that question of how long to return to the sport. So with a keyhole, you tend to have an incision which is smaller, because they remove less. They've got the ovaries rather than the uterine horns and the body. And so the traditional spay has a bigger incision site. And what they actually cut on the inside, so obviously they cut the skin, so you've got a wound to deal with. But when I started off my research, I was like, oh, there's got to be like muscle involved. But actually, interestingly, without going into too much detail, when you've got your dog's abdomen and you've got two key abdomen muscles either side, and you've got a midline, which is basically called the linea alba. And when they do spay surgery, they cut up the midline of the linea alba,
Oh,
and it's actually connective tissue, it's not muscle. So
interesting.
the two sides of the abdomen in that part where they operate is connected with connective tissue rather than muscle. So vets, good surgeons and good vets will cut without cutting the muscle itself. And
Wow.
when I actually saw this be happening, it was actually really intriguing. I could hardly see the muscle. Like, it was so thin in compared to this connective tissue. It was really fascinating. What was I saying? So yeah, there's not actually that much muscle that's actually cut and involved. They might slightly incise the edge of it, but there's not actually muscle per se cut when they do this. So going back to like healing, you've got the skin, you've got the wound that needs to heal, and you've got the connective tissue. So I think in the rehab of a spay, the first step is definitely wound management. So you'll have post-op checks. Usually our vets do like a 2 to 5 day post-op check and 11 to 12 day post-op check. And this is basically just to check the wound. So you need to check for infection, or if it's opening up again, and oozing. I think, and with my guidance to say when to return back to the sport, I think it's important to talk to vet nurses and getting your post-op checks, because your dog might have an infection and another dog might not, so their recovery might be quicker. And I think the key thing, the first step is wound management. So I think the first 2 to 5 days, they recommend making sure they don't even have a walk, leave walk. It's all rest and toilet breaks, because the main thing you don't want to do is basically overstretch that abdomen and cause the wound to break. So what's the next part? So the first step is wound management, and how a physio can come into play with that is, we're quite lucky at my vets that we have laser therapy in-house. So
Oh,
they
that's
offer
so cool.
it, if clients want it, they offer it immediately post-op, so they
I've
can
heard
laser
about
the wound.
this.
Yeah,
Yeah, it
it's
sounds
smaller
really cool.
manifestation, and laser basically helps to speed up healing.
Wow.
So while they're under sedation, they can laser the wound directly. And then when you come up for your post-op check as well, you can also be lasered then. Some clients might not have the luxury of having a vet with a laser, so you could always seek a physio to go to them to have the wound healed post-op, or you can have handheld devices at home
Oh,
that
cool.
work. I know that there's Photizo out there, which is actually an LED rather than a laser, but it has similar properties of the scientific mechanisms. I'm getting distracted. Wound healing, you can try laser early on. If there's any bruising, you can ice pack the wound.
Oh, cool.
But I think the key thing in the early days is to have your vet nurse and your vet play to let you know if, you know, the wound is got infection or it's open or not, because if the dog's chewed at it a lot, it might increase infection risk. And then after the post-op checks, it's if everything's cleared and it's okay, they tend to say after 5 days you can start to do lead walks. Mm-hmm. And actually they tend to say back to normal exercise up to 2 to 3 weeks post-op. So this is where I came in, and I was thinking, for a pet dog, maybe. you know, pet dogs that might be on the sofa all day sleeping. No, that's not every pet dog, but agility dogs, it's different. They, you know, they've got a lot more. They've got a lot more core involvement in what they do in their sport. So I think even though muscle hasn't been cut per se, there's still a midline of the abdomen been cut. So a lot of strength been lost. Mm-hmm. And tissue heals with scar. So you're going to have a lie down of scar tissue, which you want to try and basically reduce with gentle stretches and building strength back up when it's suitable for that dog. So if you've had the all clear from the vet from a wound healing perspective and infection, and then you've gradually progressively increased your exercise on lead, then you could seek a physio to help you basically target core strength. Because like you said, core strength is your abdomen, your epaxials, which run on the back of the top of your back, and then your abdomen, which is underneath. I think then you start with core exercise to try and build the strength back into that. And also trying to give it a period of time. It takes 6 to 8 weeks for muscle to heal. So, you know, after the initial wound is healed, which takes up to 2 weeks, then you got 6 to 8 weeks for muscle to heal and build full strength. So if I was to put a time frame to it, I'd say 8 to 10 weeks at a minimum. And again, every dog is different. So you'd work with your therapist to know exactly where you are in your plan. But I think it's important to not just go from your second post-op check back to full exercise and agility straight away, because you have had the dog has had the middle of their abdomen cut, whether that's spay, keyhole or overectomy, they've still had part of their abdomen cut. Yes, they might have less with the one than the other, and less of the internal side of things taken out, so theoretically less healing internally, but you've still got an element of strength to build back up. But interestingly as well, it's from a human perspective, it takes humans a lot longer to recover from abdominal surgery than dogs. So it's like,
interesting.
I've been following quite a few dogs in house and their recovery, and the way they heal is miraculous. Like how their wounds just seem to disappear. Obviously,
incredible.
If nothing happens to them, it's surprising how quickly they actually do recover. And like within 2 weeks, they could look like a normal dog.
Wow, that's really cool.
You still have the internal scarring,
and the
strength of your core reduced, but yeah.
No, that's awesome. I think that answers everything in that question, to be honest. Okay, cool. So where did we get up to? So I guess we've covered most of it. Do you want me to mention anything owners can do to build up again, or are you happy with what we've gone through so far?
I think the building up is mainly just rest to gradual progressive lead walks. You're trying to restrict overstretching of the area, like jumping up at people, jumping out of cars, jumping on counter surfaces. Because sometimes when people say rest in the veterinary industry, they don't sometimes explain what rest means. So you've got to think about the actions where their abdomen would be stretched, which you want to try and prevent. The other thing I thought about actually as well is the male side of things. So a castration itself, there's just the ball sack that is removed. So there's not as much incision site and like abdominal surgery involved, unless your dog's cryptorchid, which means you've got a retained testicle. And Astro, unfortunately, our collie had this, so he had to have this surgery last year. And when they're cryptorchid, they've got to look for that second testicle, so they could make multiple incisions. Hopefully the first incision they make, they'd find it. But with Astro, he had a couple, and one area he had it, because I'm a geek, I looked up where the incision was and taught myself what muscles were there, and they cut through like four abdominal muscles find it.
That so, is quite a lot.
Yeah, back when he had that, I was really trying to hold my boyfriend back and be like, please allow longer to let him recover. And we've got to make sure he does exercises to strengthen him back up, because he's had like a lot of muscles cut. So I think, you know, it's important to think of the male dogs when they're cryptorchid, rather than just brushing over them from a surgery point of view as well.
That's really interesting. And I think especially, like say, you know, with your boy, he had four incisions, so that's quite a lot on his muscles, I guess, and a lot to build up. And a lot of people, you know, I get, you know, with boys, we kind of push it over, you know, it's only the external, it's not that much internal, it's not going to bother them. But actually, like I say, it can do, and it's quite important to recognize that, definitely.
And also, when surgeons operate and they're looking for something, they stretch the muscle.
Ouch!
That's the other important thing to know about the spay as well. They cut up the linear alba, but then they stretch all the muscle out the way to go into the abdomen. So you've got tiny microfiber tears within the muscle, even though it's not actually incised itself.
No, it definitely, there's a real need to kind of build them back up again. Because as you say, even just listening to that, I mean, I hope no one's squeamish if you're listening, but yeah, I'd be the same. But that must be quite painful. I'm too much of an empathizer there, I think. I sympathize with the dogs, bless them. But awesome. Okay, is there anything else you want to add before we move on?
No, I don't think so. I think you're all good.
Perfect. Okay, so question 5. After a day of agility, would you recommend stretches in the evening? And if so, which ones would you use? I guess, again, this is going to be quite similar to other ones. It's very dog dependent. But if there's anything you want to kind of talk about?
Yeah, so yes, I would recommend stretches as the first answer. Like I said before, active ones are safer than passive ones, because active ones, the dog controls their movement and the end range themselves. Whilst if you passively pick up the dog's leg and stretch it, there's more of a risk of overstretching. And I think with passive stretches, it's very, very important that you have a therapist that helps teach you how to do it, because it can be dangerous. There's not many of my clients that I actually teach do this, because there's a passive range of motion and then there's the stretching part of it where they go past end range, and I just risk of the it's quite a high skill to be able to do, so there's not many of my clients that I feel that are capable of doing it. So you can do active stretches, definitely, but the other key thing to say with the stretches, you could do it alongside massage and heat therapy, because you don't want to be stretching cold tissue. So when the dog's actively recovering and they've just done an intense day of agility, their muscles shorten, you'd want to heat them up with massage and heat therapy, and then you'd go into the stretching side of things. And then it was, which stretches would you recommend? That answer is kind of, you kind of have to consider every part of the body and the key muscles that are involved in agility. So agility dogs use every part of their body really to do the sport. So it's quite hard to specify. So I just have a routine in your head of the different movements that move the different anatomical parts. And again, you'd have a therapist that leads you to do that. And also, I guess if your dog's had an injury, or there's a certain area that they're prone to getting tight, you would target more stretching to that area post exercise. It's dog dependent, and working with a therapist for definite, so that you know that you're doing the movements correctly. And I'm not saying you can't do passive stretches, but I just use someone to help you to do it. passive stretches can be used in recovery, but just not before immediate, not before you're about to exercise them doing agility or a sport.
I think it's like you say, it's having that technique, and it's like anything, you know, if you go in, it's like driving, if someone got behind a car and didn't have a clue what they were doing, they're going to cause damage. So yeah. I guess it's quite similar, you know, if you've not got any clue what you're doing, just by, you know, elongating your dog's leg, you might be causing more damage than good. So I think that's a really good point. And I like that you touched on the like heat side of it as well, being able to use, you know, your heat therapies and a little bit of massage just to help them. Because I think, again, that's something that people probably forget about is, you know, like you say, with the fibers, you don't want to be moving them and stretching them when they're cold. It's like anything, it's not going to expand as well as it can when it's nice and warm. But yeah, I know, that's really interesting. And like I say, it's very, very dog dependent, which I guess a lot of these kind of things are.
Going back to heat therapy, I think it's a very underestimated treatment technique. I think I use it a lot in sports dogs, agility dogs, because it's quite a convenient thing to do as well. Just putting heat therapy on and warming up the body and just improving muscle extensibility and blood flow. It's a technique that I quite like recommending owners to do post agility and exercise.
Awesome. Okay. I'm just thinking as well, for anyone listening who's not aware of what heat therapy is, do you want to give a little bit of little bit of a description, if that's okay? I'm just thinking someone will be like, what do I do for that? And I'm sure that question will come up.
So heat therapy, it's like a hot water bottle or a Wheaties beanie bag that you put in the microwave or a clicky gel heat pad. Heat therapy is any external source that you put onto the body. It's warm, it to touch, to put on the body.
Awesome, cool. I think that clarifies it, because I know there'll be someone out there thinking, what do I do for that? And that person would probably be me half the time, so I'm just helping those out who are like me. Awesome. Okay, so next question, if you're happy for us to move on. This is going to be a long one, I think. What are the most common agility injuries you treat, and how can they be prevented?
So the most common injuries that I have treated in agility dogs absolutely is soft tissue injuries. Mm-hmm. So what I mean by soft tissue is like muscles, tendons, ligaments, and it's because of the repetitive strain nature of the sport. You easily get microfibers within all those soft tissues, and they get sprains, strains, tears, varying degrees of severity. You know, muscle strains are graded from a scale of 1 to 4, and it depends on how many fibers you've torn to how long it would take for them to recover, and how much healing is involved. And I think from an anatomical location with agility dogs, the areas where you get the most soft tissue injuries tend to be the shoulders, the biceps, the supraspinatus, and a condition called medial shoulder syndrome, where multiple shoulder muscles are involved, and it creates the instability. Iliopsoas in the hip, that's quite a common one as well. And also lower back muscle. There's a muscle called the iliocostalis, which is part, it's attached to the pelvis and the lower back. The lower back is the most mobile part of the spine, because it hasn't got the rib cage supporting it, the shoulder cavity or the hip joint, the pelvis. So you tend to get a lot of microfibers within the lower back as well. That's probably where I get the most injuries. And prevention. One of my massive things with prevention is owner education. So teaching my clients and my owners how to detect the subtle changes, because a lot of the soft tissue injuries are only subtle. And I think I said this before, your dog does not have to be lame to have an injury.
Yeah.
So they might develop a muscle asymmetry, posture changes, sticking a leg out when they're sitting, for example, or leaning off a leg. And if I can help to teach owners how to look for those things, and also teach them what their dog's normal is, because every dog's conformation is different. And if they know that their dog holds their, you know, one of their joints in a certain way, they'll know that's normal. So they can advise that there's no change there. So I think owner education is one of the key things for prevention. And I love doing workshops on how to teach owners to look out for good form and posture, so they can detect early signs of injury. Prevention. Other thing for prevention is overtraining. So tired muscles are more prone to injuries. If you've worked them a lot, they're more likely to create more microfibers within the muscle. Another prevention would be warming up before training and competing. Yeah. So it improves your muscle extensibility and resilience to load. Conditioning soft tissue, so building their strength, their extensibility, their endurance. And what's something else with prevention? Preventing. Oh, proprioceptive system. So if you challenge your dog's proprioceptive system or got exercises that target that, your dogs might be able to adapt to the different surfaces that they run on, recover from a fall if they fall off the dog walk a lot quicker, if their nervous system is been trained more regularly throughout their training program. That'll also prevent an injury because they've got better recovery from their falls. Other preventions like your massage, your chiro, having physio treatments frequently to check up for any injuries, and again catching them early, and education the owners so they can find it, and you can pick up on it sooner. I think the main thing with agility dogs is the soft tissue side of things. And you know, the amount of period of time that it takes them to recover will depend on the degree of muscle fibers that are torn. And sometimes people don't realize how long that can take, you know, from muscle, which takes 6 to 8 weeks, which tendons that can take 4 to 6 months.
Wow.
And ligaments that can take 12 plus months. I was going to nearly say years then. Although, to be fair, some soft tissue injuries can result in your dog being retired if
wow.
they become. And I think, you know, with soft tissue injuries as well, that area that they've injured then becomes vulnerable. And, you know, I've mentioned all like warming up and massage and all that, and targeting it towards areas where your dog is injured, because they've got that now to live with for the rest of their life. They've got that weakness in that area. So you're going to have to target that all the time to help prevent it from basically fraying anymore around the edges of the scar tissue. So yeah, you got a more vulnerable site there. Was that?
Yeah, no, that's amazing. And I think, like I say, it is very important to get those prevention things in there. And I really like that you've touched on the subtle changes, because I think that's something that a lot of us kind of miss, unless the dog's lame. You know, people very much of the time, oh, they're all right, there's nothing wrong with them. But I mean, I've kind of, from sort of my own dogs, sort of seen it in, like, suddenly they'll start missing the weave entry, or they'll pop out of the weaves, or there'll be certain things that are very unusual for them to do, I guess. And I assume that's a huge thing for them. I noticed as well, actually, with one of mine, the hair on his back, like his hair, like the shape of his hair changed. And I think, again, that's something that, like, you know, with the subtle changes, a lot of things people don't really even notice, or you might just think, oh, that's just the way they've been laid. But, you know, it can sometimes, I guess, be down to little tiny changes in the body that we need to kind of keep an eye out for.
Yeah, definitely. And I feel like people find it fascinating as well when you do point out these things that they can look for.
Absolutely.
I've done a gait analysis workshop, and I just basically through how different dogs are moving on the day. And it's just basically training owners to look at their dog and know what to look for with what part of their movement to look at. And then they find it really fascinating. And, like, even if they identify that that's their normal for their dog, you know, knowing your dog's normal is important, so you can know they're abnormal and when it's changed from that. Owner education is one of my passions from that point of view. Definitely.
Amazing. I think it's such a, you know, if we're asking our dogs to do so much, it's the least we could do for them is educate ourselves on how to keep them fit and healthy. So I think that's really cool.
Yeah, and dogs are not like humans. They won't cry out in pain. They literally are so robust and will hide it, completely hide it until they do become lame, which is when, you know, if a dog's lame, they're quite severe. You know, they progress through all those other stages of subtlety and maybe behavioral changes that you've not picked up on. And then they've gone to the point where they're lame. So yeah, dogs don't, I get it a lot with, you know, oh, but my dog's not crying out in pain, but they don't, they hide it. They've got a high
Yeah.
work ethic, depending on the breed as well. They, you know, they're bred to work. So they'll just keep going until it gets really severe.
Absolutely. We've for context, we've got a rescue. He's never done agility properly. He just dabbled in a little bit and when I'm training my own, but he suddenly started to lose muscle, which again, like you've said earlier, you know, knowing how your dog's kind of muscles are and the sizing and things. He started to lose muscle. We'd gone to our physio and they said, oh, I'd get him scanned or, you know, get kind of an x-ray done and just see what's underlying. And even they were shocked what came back because he was hiding it that well. He almost needed a double hip replacement because it was, I think there's something to do with the ball joint. I can't remember for the life of me what it is, what he specifically got. But yeah, they hide, like you say, they hide it so well and they're not going to tell you when they are. They just carry on. Oh yeah, I'll run around a field, no problem. And then I'll feel it the next day. Absolutely. So I think, yeah, just being able to spot those little things and watch them is so important because, yeah, they won't tell us, unfortunately.
Yeah, and I think you going on mentioning dogs' hips, like some agility dogs, you know, that they tend to get soft tissue injuries from doing the sport, but some of them might have congenital or developmental joint issues
Yeah.
that you don't know about, that might be underlying. And you know, I work with a lot of dogs that do have joint dysfunctions of varying, like luxating patella or cruciate or things like that. But again, doesn't mean they don't have to do agility. You just have to tailor it towards them and understand how it impacts the dog.
Yeah.
But again, they will hide conditions like that very easily as well, like you've just mentioned.
Yeah. Yeah, it's surprising what they'll what they won't show you until they're old and then they go, actually, I can't cope with that anymore.
Yeah.
Awesome. Okay, so last question. This is like a nice fun one, I think, to finish on. What are the benefits of hydrotherapy? And would you work with a pool or a treadmill more for agility dogs?
Yeah, I like this question too, because I love using hydrotherapy within my treatment techniques. So the benefits, so you're working in a body of water. So you've got the water properties that help with like buoyancy. So it's a less impactful form of conditioning your dog because whether it's pool or treadmill, it reduces the load through the joints. So you've got less impact through the joints itself. You've got warm water. So all hydrotherapy centers, if they're regulated, should be between 28 to 32 degrees. So you're going to increase blood flow and circulation and the temperature of the body itself. And with increasing body temperature, you're going to reduce muscle tightness, improve range of motion, flexibility, stride length. Hydrotherapy is also proprioceptively enriched. So, and also depending on the center you go to, this can be targeted with different surfaces. So if you're at a treadmill, you've got the treadmill plate itself that moves and that texture under their feet. But if you go to a pool and they've got like a track around the outside, some centers will have different surfaces on them.
Oh, cool.
So that's proprioceptively challenging them, and also going from transitions. So if you go from a stand to a walk to a trot on the treadmill, that challenges their proprioception. And the same if you go from a walk to a swim in the pool. You've also got the resistance that the water provides. So you're going to be targeting more muscle strength and muscle development. Hydrotherapy also reduces inflammation, so if they've got any inflammation that might be at play, gosh, what else? There's loads of different things. cardiovascular fitness, so you can target it towards like the anaerobic or aerobic cycles and think about how long you do the exercise for, improve their stamina. Yeah, a lot of benefits. What's the second part of the question? Pool or treadmill? So
yes,
I love working with both, and at the moment, unfortunately, I don't work with the pool because at the vets they've only got a treadmill, an underwater treadmill. When I graduated, I worked down south and they had a pool and a treadmill. So on a regular day-to-day basis, I'd have to clinically reason in my head, am I going to use the pool or am I going to use the treadmill with this dog? But from an agility perspective, I think they both are advantageous. But I think the important question is thinking about what's going to be done with the piece of equipment. And how does it target your goals for your dog, your fitness goals for your dog, and what do you want to achieve? So unfortunately, in the hydrotherapy industry, there's no set protocol on how to use the pool or how to use the treadmill. So
interesting.
There's a huge variability on how hydrotherapists use the equipment. So I think communication between your hydrotherapist and you is very important, and touching on their experience as well. But if we think about an underwater treadmill, you can set more specific programs and protocols with it because you can vary water depth, you can vary speed, you can vary time, rest periods, and also some have an incline. So you can go up or down,
cool.
Decline as well. If you can reverse the belt, you can do decline. So there's varying ways of leveling the intensity for the dog, and along with like, how long you do a rest period to how long they're actually moving. The treadmill also provides straight line movement only. So I guess if you're recovering from, it's good in rehabilitation if you're recovering from an injury and you want them to be in a static straight line movement rather than the sideways and the adduction and circling, it provides straight line movement only. And it mimics their gait pattern. So it's a more natural movement because you've got the walk and the trot rather than swimming, which is a completely different movement in itself. What else does the treadmill provide? I think with my experience with treadmill, I absolutely love using it because it's surprising how much you can pick up on your dog, how your dogs move. And actually slow mowing them down and making them walk, because a lot of dogs spend their day to day in trot. Because it's the most comfortable, or gallop or run. And you know, when you make them walk, it tends to flag up an asymmetry or sometimes an injury that you might not know that's there, because you're making them use all four legs in a slow controlled manner. So I like using the treadmill from that perspective, from being able to detect injuries and helping educate owners on how their dogs move, from slow mowing their motion. It's been absolutely fascinating. So I like working with the treadmill from that point of view. Comparing it to the pool, I think the pool you can use, you've got the swimming, the cardiovascular element of the swimming. You can use rapid changes of direction. You can do tight and loose turns, which are related to agility. It's completely non-weight bearing. So if you've done a lot of agility recently and a lot of training and you've overloaded the joints, you can continue to work the cardiovascular system, but take the load completely off their joints when they're swimming. I think also with swimming, their muscles are used in a completely different way. So, you know, cross training and challenging their body in a completely different way to like their natural walking and trotting motion. And with swimming as well, when I did have the pool, again, I'd ask that question with people, what have you done recently within your training program? Have you trained recently? And if they had, I would choose to do an active recovery session in the pool rather than targeting cardiovascular and going high speed and different turns and doing more of recovery sessions. So this would be slower motions. You can use massage and stretching techniques because I've got the physio side of things as well as the hydro. I can use that in the pool. And I can assess the dog's muscle condition and their weight bearing as well. So, choosing which one to use is kind of, I think it's also what's available to you as well,
Yeah.
because there's so many different hydrotherapy centers, like geographically, it's trying to find one that's close to you. But I think key thing is to talk to the therapist about what you want out of it. If you're wanting your dog to have, you know, a higher heart rate, they can recover quickly, they can swim your dog for a period of 60 seconds, which is how long an agility run can be up to. Their heart rate and their capillary refill to see how long their recovery is. So I think, and the same again with the treadmill, you can have a certain plan. I think that's the nice thing with the treadmill in a way, is because you can have a more set plan. You can say, okay, I've done this many minutes of this speed, this much rest, water level, this incline. And then next time you can increase, you know how to increase it specifically, yeah. To test the dog and how they cope with it over a period of time. So I think there's no technique that's good or bad or worse than the other. I think, you know, ultimately, if you wanted the fittest dog in the world, you could do both. But
yeah,
financial side of things, you wouldn't be able to do both. But I think if you're deciding between the two, I'd think about what your dog's recently done. So
yeah.
I think maybe the pool is better for an active recovery session, because it completely takes the load off the joints,
yeah.
And you can still work on their cardiovascular fitness. Whilst the treadmill, the weight bearing is still reduced with the water, but they've still got to load their joints,
yeah.
When they're walking on the plate. Yeah, that's a roundabout way to answer the question.
No,
but
it's really good.
You kind of think about, I think the thing is how the equipment's used, I think, is important. And it would be great if there was some more research into it and how specifically it would help improve an agility dog for their sport, and like injury prevention side of things. It would be fascinating. And if anyone knows any who's listening, please
yeah.
let me know.
Yeah, absolutely.
We always love reading research and learning more about things. Yeah.
Awesome. No, yeah. I think that was really cool.
I do miss the pool, to be fair. I do miss the pool a lot. You know, and I've thought about hiring pools nearby with my dogs. Water management is also a key thing, I think, with hydrotherapy as well. Cleanliness, and I'm a bit of a clean freak. So I would not let my dogs in unsanitized water.
Yeah, absolutely.
Train that way from a hydrotherapist. So yeah, I think it's also like what they're swimming in as well, from a hydrotherapy point, is important.
Yeah, that's interesting, and that's something I guess not a lot of us would think about. Some of us have got dogs that would just quite happily jump into the nearest lake or stream, which isn't always the cleanest, as you say. And I guess, you know, it comes into the factor of hydrotherapy pools as well. You know, you've got lots of dogs coming in and out. So that's quite an interesting point, actually. Yeah. And I think
there's so much cleaning involved. You don't realise there's so much cleaning involved
oh, I
when
can
it comes
imagine.
To hydrotherapy.
And all the
massive
hair
part
as well. A lot of dog hair.
And you get the hairiest, dirtiest dogs ever. Like, I think they've never been groomed in their life, and then they get in the water and it all comes out.
If anyone listening, bath your dog at least a few days before, because it's not a bath just going to the hydrotherapy pool. It's not just so they can get a groom. But no, that's really cool, and thank you so much for that, because I've learned a lot in the duration. So I think it's been a really interesting conversation, and I like to talk about these things because I think it's so important from, like we said, you know, dog's welfare point of view. The more we kind of spread the message, and you know, it doesn't always have to be an expense, but I guess, you know, there's things in here that we've talked about that people can kind of take away, and that's not cost them anything. So no, thank you so much for your expertise. Before we finish, could you share where people can get in touch with you if they're interested in coming to you for physiotherapy, and any other details you've got, I guess the workshops as well, if you've got any of those planned, that would be really cool.
So I haven't got any workshops planned at the moment, but any clubs or agility clubs that are interested in knowing more, the kind of workshops that I tend to do are warm up, cool down, gait analysis, how to detect injury, looking at form and posture. I'm definitely going to do more throughout the summer at different clubs.
Amazing.
But if you like it specifically, just let me know. From a contacting point of view, my email is sjt/vetphysio@gmail.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Instagram. I believe my thing is just SJT Vet Physio, and it may have dog training on the end, which I don't do anymore, but it's SJT Vet Physio and dog training on Facebook and Instagram. Unfortunately, don't have a website at the moment, but I am building one, but
Hey.
that's not up yet. But yes, you can find me on social media, and my inbox is always open if you're a Facebook friend on Facebook as well.
Oh, awesome. I mean, I'll put some links to your Facebook page and your Instagram page as well. So that would be really cool if anyone wants to get in touch. And I really like that. I think it would be really awesome if some clubs and, even if it's just private trainers got in touch to get some workshops booked, because it's so helpful. I think, getting out and doing it in person makes such a difference. So yeah, I'll keep an eye out for those for myself as well. So awesome. No, thank you so much. Is there anything you want to add before we go, or is you happy?
Nope, I think that's about it. Thank you for having me.
Perfect.
Thank you for
Oh
everyone listening.
yeah, thank you. Thank you so much.
So just to wrap this episode up then, I want to say a huge thank you to Sammy for your time and expertise, and also a big thank you to our listeners as well if you've stayed this long. So I'm going to put a link to Sammy's Instagram and her Facebook page. So if you are interested in either getting in touch for your own dogs, or maybe you have an agility club and want to book Sammy for a workshop day, you'll be able to find all her information there. And as always, our sponsors' information will be in the show notes too. Thank you so much, and have a great week.